Hello, welcome to VR Roundtable, episode 69. My name is Gary and joining me is Steve and Chris. Unfortunately, Anthony is unable to join us this week. He's a little bit busy working on his website and his channel, VR Game Rankings, so definitely go over and check that out if you get a chance. Also, we just wanted to mention, because last week we had Epic's on the show, it was Epic's 911, now it's Epic's VR. Definitely check his channel out. He joined us and we did have a very, very positive response from having Epic's on the show. And we just want to make it clear, you know, we'll definitely be having him back on as a guest at some point, you know, hopefully not too long in the future. So stay tuned for that as well. But anyway, we've got a few new stories to go through this week and a few games, so we can get straight into it. The first one we wanted to talk about, and this is coming out of Tested, they had a video on their projection series about where they had a hands-on with the Vive Pro. And this was really, really interesting because the Tested guys, obviously, you know, they have sort of the expertise and the knowledge and also the contacts in order to get access to this kind of stuff and give hands-on impressions, which are very, very valuable to consumers that are looking to buy this kind of stuff. But within this video, they went through a few things and we'll go through these one by one. The first one I wanted to talk about is the resolution, which is probably the most important part of the Vive Pro for people that are upgrading. And Norm took a photo through the lenses of the Vive Pro and also the original Vive just to do like a comparison between the two, and it gives some interesting results. I thought it looked pretty, it looked like an upgrade. There was definitely an upgrade in there. I guess it's just how significant that is when you're looking at it on a screen and how significant it is in a headset. It's difficult to work out at this stage. Chris, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I think it definitely is a major improvement. Steve, do you have like the side-by-side up on the screen?
Yep, I got it
for
up.
People? Okay, cool. Just kind of looking at it real blown up, I feel like I can't even read the text on like the left side, which is the original Vive, really that well. And then on the Vive Pro, it's all easy to read. So I think that's definitely kind of signifies the difference there. But, you know, as we know, it's not like a big leap or anything. It's definitely a minor improvement, but I'm just really more interested to find out how this affects, you know, games with textures and the textures being far away, just kind of having more clarity. But just based on this, I think it's, you know, it's promising. It's nothing we haven't seen before or like haven't already known, but it's nice to just have the actual Vive Pro rather than the Samsung Odyssey. Because I think until then, or since this video, we only had kind of a comparison of the Odyssey versus the Vive, whereas this is the actual Vive Pro screen.
Yeah, I think the test is somewhat inherently flawed. Like, I'm not trying to discredit them at all, because hopefully if I was in that situation, I would have done something similar, at least had enough sense to. But it is a person holding a cell phone up to grab the image. And there's a lot of things, you know, depending on the amount of light and everything, you know, cell phones can do a longer exposure. But that being said, I think it does accurately convey the idea. Now, I've not used the Vive Pro myself yet, but I have used some of the MR headset. Well, one of the MR headsets, and it is a higher resolution, not quite as high as the Vive Pro, but what I'm seeing in this comparison does sort of, to a degree, reflect what I remember seeing, you know, in going between my Vive and the MR headset. So I think what they're trying to show is sort of convey an idea. This isn't something that you'd want Eurogamer or somebody like that going through and pixel counting and trying to compare in that way, because it is just a picture through one lens of through another lens of the headset. So it's not intended to be completely to be a complete comparison in that sense, but I think it does convey the general gist, and I think everyone is going to appreciate the improvements that the resolution makes. But I also, at the same time, and I think I said this when we discussed it at CES when the Vive Pro was announced, is I think you when you put that Vive Pro headset on for the first time, I don't think your socks are going to be necessarily blown away by the resolution increase. At that moment, you're going to have all sorts of sensory, you know, is it more comfortable? You're going to be comparing all these things, and the resolution is going to look better. But what I think you would notice more, And again, this is just my experience, is when you take that headset off and put a lower res headset on, I think you're going to feel the downstep in resolution more than you feel that initial step up. But either way, this is what we want to see, and the resolution improvement is definitely wanted.
Yeah, they seem to focus a lot as well on the fact that the text is more noticeable than anything else. The fact that you have readable text with this step up in resolution, which is always good. Playing games like Elite Dangerous, for example, where playing it originally on the Vive, there was sort of a little bit of a problem in the way that particular game was rendered. The text wasn't particularly clear. And, you know, you're constantly wanting these things, especially in a game like that I play a lot. You want these particular things to be clear. And as Chris was saying, you know, things like, for me, when I'm playing games like Fallout 4 or Skyrim with these huge vistas and that kind of stuff, where you're looking at things in the distance, even racing games, Project Cars, for example, you're constantly looking in the distance with those. So if you can play some, have an increase in resolution with that at those points, then I think that would be great. We'll have to see, because I don't know how much of a difference this is. And I take your point, Steve, you know, going back, it might not appear a significant upgrade until you then go back to an older headset or something like that, and then you really do appreciate what they're doing on top of that there. Okay, the other thing on this tested video that came out, and it's a little bit concerning for me, is Jeremy mentioned the fact that the God rays seem a little bit more pronounced in the Vive Pro, and he put this down to the fact that because the resolution is higher, the screen seems slightly brighter and everything seems more accentuated, including the God rays. So from the Fresnel lenses, you have these concentric circles which are sort of reflect the light out, and it is a distraction. And this is one of the main things for me, which I find in the current generation of headsets, the Rift and the Vive, the most distracting when I'm trying to get immersed within an experience. And it's especially so since I've got a PSVR, where this isn't so much of a problem. I really do like the fact that you don't have those on the PSVR quite so much, or even at all, really. So I was hoping that would be slightly different in this Vive Pro. What do you guys think?
Well, you know, like, I think Jeremy and I remember when they did their video on the Pimax, I think he kind of sort of focused on lenses, and for whatever reasons, that must be something that I guess in VR distracts him more and he pays attention to it, which is great for me because I also focus on lenses. As everyone can see, I'm wearing glasses. I've talked about wearing glasses in the past. I have an astigmatism. I cannot wear contacts. I would need a sort of a procedure that isn't LASIK that would get me away from glasses, and I'm not making that jump just yet. So what I think happens, just speaking personally, is that any God ray or any light blooming effect is sort of magnified for me. Like, it's going through my glasses and getting it even more. So I really, really, really appreciate a reduced God ray effect, or just artifacting as a whole. And even before VR, when I was playing standard games, I hate a light blooming effect. And seems like a lot of games do that. Like, the industry as a whole likes it, but I personally can't stand it. So I hate the God rays or the ghosting on the Rift. I hate the concentric rings and the artifacts on the Vive. So it is a little, you know, I don't want to say frustrating, because I almost understand what they were doing with the Vive Pro, but I wished they would have taken this opportunity to do something else. And on the promo video, when the Vive Pro was launched, there was some text that popped up, and it said improved lenses or state-of-the-art lenses. It said something on that video, and I'll go back and try to remember to put it in the description of this show, the exact phrasing. But in that promo video by HTC, they hinted towards there being some sort of change in the lenses, and from, as far as what we know, what people were saying out of CES, and now what Jeremy and Norm are saying, there doesn't appear to be a change. Now, perhaps there was, and maybe the change is subtle, and that you can't just tell with a naked test, a naked eye test. But at the same time, it's like, damn it! Like, you know, I really wish they would have taken the opportunity to sort of rectify that issue.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. I was just going to say, on their promo video, it says enhanced optics. And I feel like that's kind of like, basically, that's just a lie, I think. It seems like they're the exact same lenses as before, which I feel like is just stupid, because that's really the thing that could make the most difference in kind of making something better than the existing Vive or existing Rift? Like, just any improvements in optics, you know, like we know the Oculus Go is going to have second gen optics. I think that's really one of the easiest things to kind of put R&D into and actually make better. So that's a little bit disappointing for me, since I'll probably be getting a Vive Pro, but it is what it is, I guess. Like, I'm they don't bother me as much as they bother you, Steve, but you know, it's never ideal.
Yeah. Okay, just a couple of other quick points I want to get through. This was with this tested video, they did sort of confirm that the Vive ones, the new Vive ones that will be accompanying this as a bundle later on in the year, are basically the same form factor as the original Vive ones. They look exactly the same, although they've got some color in. I think they've got some blue on there as well. But other than that, they're exactly the same, but they do contain updated sensors, so they're compatible with the base station 2.0. So that's interesting. You know, there doesn't seem to be anything other than the fact that they've got these updated sensors in there. So, and also on the headphones, this was a bigger point than I ever thought it would be. But on a video we did when the Vive Pro was first announced, one of us, I don't know exactly who, but I think one of us said that the headphones can't be removed, and the rest of us went along with that. And I didn't know at that time specifically, because there was a lot of reporting that was contradicting each other when we recorded that show. But the information was available. Had we looked for it hard enough, I'm sure we could have found it, but we didn't really realize that it was going to be such a big point of contention for people that watched that video. But anyway, the headphones for the Vive Pro can be removed. They need to be unscrewed, and then you can remove them and use your own headphones in there. But yeah, on those two points, Steve, what do you think?
Well, the it was credible information. It wasn't me that said it, but it was I think it was either Upload or Road 2 had an article that they edited twice. Like, initially they said they were removable. They went back in, edited the article, and said that they weren't removable, and then went back in days later and edited a third time or a second time to say that yes, they were removable. So I think HTC wasn't very clear that day or two or so after revealing the Vive Pro on whether or not they're removable, and we still haven't seen what that removal looks like. And if you look at the headset, it kind of protrudes a lot, like right in that headband area where the headphones attach. And exactly where is it removable? And I almost wonder if, even though it's technically removable, is it going to be a situation where people can freely use a wide range of over-the-ear headphones? It's kind of like the PlayStation VR. Like, it's got that thick headband, and it makes it difficult. Like, I can't use these Sony Golds that I'm wearing right now. I can't use those on the PlayStation VR because it's too thick around the headband. And I almost wonder if the Vive Pro is going to be a little bit like that. Earbuds are obviously, you can definitely wear those without issue on any headset. So I think, yeah, it's technically removable, but I think it remains to see just how much that's going to be usable to the consumer. Your other point on the controllers, it's a little bit of a bummer. They didn't take an opportunity, sort of like the lenses, to make any improvement there. Like, they're just kind of making the same ones, throwing the updated 2.0 sensors on it and giving it a blue coat of paint and calling it a day. It goes back to that whole idea of were they maybe hoping Knuckles would be available. And I know Knuckles is a Valve product, but right now there's no other Steam VR headset, you know, marketed and produced in this way. If Valve were to release the Knuckles, they would either have to sell it themselves, or ideally it would be coming through HTC. So I don't know. It goes back, and I'll quit rambling here after I make this last point, is Jeremy and Norm, I think they both, but I think Jeremy accented more on this particular video. He said this Vive Pro is there'll be a lot of consumers that want it. The hardcore, dedicated, high-end consumer will want it. But they said that part of this focus from HTC was to give it to manufacturers, you know, like BMW. I think they use BMW as an example. Like, the car design, the person at BMW or the team at BMW that's designing the shape of the car, the fender panels, you know, the whole contour, like they want a better headset, you know, to look at the models and things like that. So he kind of said that maybe they were pushing the Vive Pro as a sort of an enterprise or an industrial type emphasis, not just consumers. And this would support that, the fact that really it's just a higher res Vive with Steam tracking 2.0.
Yeah, some of the language that Daniel O'Brien was talking when they were announcing this Vive Pro at that conference just before CES, the language he was using made me think, you know, this is not really aimed. I mean, I guess they can sell it to consumers and there will be a lot of consumers enthusiasts that will be picking this thing up. But the language he was using really wasn't focusing in on that at all. And it seemed to me like he was making a point of saying that as well, aiming more at the sort of the industry professionals kind of market. As you say, you know, they've worked a lot with these car manufacturers in order to demonstrate cars so you can look around, take a virtual tour of these cars and that kind of stuff. And it does point to that. I don't know whether they're moving overall in that kind of direction or if that's just sort of something they want to push with this particular model of the Vive. But yeah, it's an interesting point. Chris, you know, I think you've said that you will be picking up a Vive Pro. What do you think of these headphones, the fact that they'll be removable? Will you be doing that or do you think you'll stick with the ones that are included?
Yeah, I don't know why people care about that too much. Like, as long as the headphones are decent, like the Rift, no one's going to want to remove them. Like, do you ever see anyone with a Rift with their headphones removed? Like, I guess in the beginning people were. Like, I remember when they first came out, people were like, ooh, I can remove them and put my own. But no one does that. It's just so easy to have the headphones there already that I think that's not really that big of a deal. But I'm kind of disappointed with the controllers. I mean, I did say, I think last week or the week before, that like it looked like the controllers are just blue and they're the same. So I guess that's just kind of confirmed now that they're the same. But I mean, to your point, it makes sense that it's just an industrial product, but I just feel like they could have marketed it more as that. Like, calling it the Vive Pro makes consumers want it, whereas like calling it a Vive Enterprise Edition or something, or like renewing the Enterprise Edition Vive that already exists, would have kind of made it more enterprise. But I guess HTC just wants all the money, so it's fine. They just want to make sure anyone would buy it who wants it. But yeah, I mean, it's disappointing, but I guess it's to be expected that if it's for enterprise primarily, that the controllers are the same.
Yeah, I guess they'll just play it by ear. You know, they're not going to not sell it to people if people want to buy it. So they're sort of hedging their bets in some ways. I think they are sort of aiming it towards industry, but a lot of consumers, you know, enthusiast first adopters will be picking this thing up, and it could sort of cement Vive as being sort of the best high-end VR. If you do want to go in for the absolute high-end consumer level VR, that's the one you need to get. And it could work well for them. We'll see how it goes. The last couple of points on this are the so from this tested video, again, it was the fact that it seems to have a single connection to the headset now, rather than having the 3-in-1 cable where you have independent connection. So you have a HDMI connection, a USB, and a power connection. Now it's all integrated into one single connection and one single cable going to the breakout box. Then from the new breakout box, you do have three further connections going to the PC. As usual, you know, it connects in pretty much the same way, I believe. So that's all interesting stuff. But the final thing is the fact that these dual cameras, now they didn't really go in too much in the video on tested, because they weren't really given any answers on what these cameras are going to be used for. I mean, I think we can make best guesses. It's going to be sort of a pass through in a similar way to how we had on the original Vive to sort of complement the chaperone system, so you can sort of use it to view your play space and that kind of stuff. However, there was this Engadget article where they had an interview with HTC Vive's vice president Raymond Powell, and he was talking about in that article where they could use these cameras potentially for sort of basic hand tracking. He did say that there was going to be a sort of these were very low resolution cameras, similar to how they were in the original Vive, but there's two of them, so they can use them for basic hand tracking. And that's interesting. Even if they can get to a point where it's kind of like how, do you remember that keyboard that was announced a few months ago where they said that they can overlay the Vive camera so you can actually just see your fingers operating on this tracked keyboard? So even if they can get that kind of functionality with this, so you can use something like with a slightly wider field of view, so you can use something like a HOTAS or a steering wheel, just so you can see your hands within the VR play space and overlay them within the VR world, I think that would be great. But if they can do something even beyond that, where there is interaction, kind of like a magic leap motion kind of integration with this, I would love something like that to be built into these headsets. I think that's really valuable. Chris, have you got any thoughts on that?
I think that they're just kind of throwing out all these things that could happen and they actually don't have anything working. I mean, that's, I guess that's obvious since there's no demo or anything. I feel like two cameras really isn't enough information for good hand tracking, but like you said, it is possible that they could maybe make it so you could just see where your hands are and not necessarily interact. I think that could be totally something that's possible. But yeah, I don't know. Also in this article, they said like when we first designed the camera, we wanted to use it to enhance Chaperone and let it detect boundaries more automatically and more accurately. So like, I don't know, maybe it'll finally be able to actually figure out where the walls are, because I know like that was originally what they kind of wanted with the one camera, but there's no depth that you can get from that. At least with the, when there's stereo cameras, they can try to triangulate where stuff is, so that would be cool. I remember like when the camera first came out, wasn't there rumors of like if the dog comes in the play space, it'll know that and all this stuff. So I just hope that they'll be able to build in some of this functionality that we've always kind of wanted with the cameras, but then just ended up turning them off because they never worked right. They always broke tracking for me at least.
Well, I think what they're doing is they are looking to put it out there, give the hardware, and hope that developers take advantage of it. Hope that, I don't think they, HTC, are going to do much with it. I don't believe that necessarily that Valve is going to do much with it, because, you know, Valve is focused on more of the wide headset support as opposed to just doing things specifically for the HTC Vive. So I think it doesn't hurt. I think it's interesting that they chose to spend some money to keep, not only keep a camera in the headset at all, but to add a second one. I'm intrigued by it. I don't have a lot of confidence that it's going to be widely utilized. I thought it was a good idea with the original Vive, and I tinkered with it when I first got my Vive and thought it was neat. But like most people, I went ahead and disabled it so that it wouldn't saturate the USB bandwidth. And, you know, I kind of never really used it beyond that. So if they can come up with good utility, if a developer can come up with good utility, if Valve bakes a good utility into OpenVR for it, then I'm excited for that, because I think there's opportunity. I just don't know if it can be realized. But going back, I wanted to actually talk about that singular case. Right now, if you have an original Vive, and if you some reason lose your link box or your link box fails, you can just plug the HDMI cables and things. You know, you can get a power adapter. I know I've read people that have done that to get power supplied to it. Whereas with this new Vive Pro, like you have to have a link box. Period. Like that connector, I don't think is gonna really, you know, unless someone makes some sort of adapter. It's not a standard connector. I don't have USB-C myself, so I'm not as familiar with what USB-C looks like, but I don't think it's a standard USB-C connector, is it?
No, it's not. No, it's like a proprietary cable, I believe, that they've designed.
So that's an interesting idea for me in the sense that it now makes the link box required. And again, it's probably going to come with the headset, even when you buy the headset only, it obviously has to come with it. So it's not something that requires a kit. But I think that's interesting in the event that if your link box fails, your whole HMD is rendered unusable.
Yeah, it's interesting also just for the wireless adapter, because looking at it, it never had this type of connector on it. So I'm wondering if they're going to have to ship a cable that converts the regular Vive into the three separate things again for the wireless adapter or something. It's very strange. I kind of wish they could figure out how to make it more standardized. Like even if it was a type C connector that could do power and HDMI, like all that stuff's possible today. So it's weird that it's this really tiny proprietary one way thing. I don't know.
You know, I don't know why it isn't just power over USB like all the other headsets. Like there isn't a separate power feed for the PlayStation VR and the Rift. And the only thing I conclude, the Vive is by far the brightest. So I'm assuming the Vive Pro will retain a sort of similar brightness, but maybe that backlighting or whatever they're doing to get that higher brightness requires a higher level of power.
I think part of it as well, because they do have in the original Vive, they have the USB, the USB slot in there that you can add extra peripherals in, like the Leap Motion, for example. So I guess that's what they were really trying to use that power cable for. I'm sure they could get it working without an extra power source within there, but then they wouldn't have that extra functionality. Although that really wasn't used a great deal. I mean, you had these things like the fans and that kind of stuff that people were using. Yeah. So I guess it was all to do with that. But yeah, I think there's compromise, isn't there, with this cable. Having a single cable, it's better in some ways, because I guess presumably it will be lighter, it will be less intrusive than the 3-in-1 cable. But then, yeah, like you say, Chris, it's not standardized. And Steve, you know, we won't be able to easily replace this thing. So you're up against all of these obstacles as well. It's all compromises that HTC have decided to go forward with this. But again, just on that final point of the USB-C, there is no reason why they couldn't eventually move towards that kind of standard. I think that would be the way forward in the long term, and I'd love to see that. Although maybe by then we'll all be wireless anyway, so it won't matter. Okay, so that's pretty much all we've got on the Vive Pro from the tested video. So thanks a lot for tested for doing that, because we've just covered pretty much what you went through on there, but it's just our impressions of it. It's always good, you know, tested. I absolutely love their channel, and they do go into all the things that I want to ask these people, and they sort of cover all these little points that I'm interested in. So I'm glad they're out there. Couple of smaller news stories. I won't stay on these too long. The first one is at the Sundance Festival, there was this VR, I believe it's a 360 video, but it's by Darren Aronofsky, and it's called Spheres. And this is the first part of what will be a series of 360 films that he's developing. And it actually landed a 7-figure deal at the Sundance Festival. So this is the largest ever known deal for a VR-focused project, which is really encouraging. The fact that it obviously caught people's attention to this extent. And, you know, it's got some big names in it. Darren Aronofsky is a big director. So it's all good news for VR. Has anybody got any thoughts they want to mention on this one at all?
I don't know. I think it's just good for the VR film industry that this type of stuff is starting to happen. Because I know, like, anyone who wants to make a VR film usually has, like, no funding and has to kind of do it themselves or have a company that was already doing films. So I think this will just kind of give a lot of people more weight in making their own VR movies. So that's cool.
Yeah, I think in, if nothing else, it's a headline. It's a good headline that people can sort of see sort of in the mainstream. It's more of like a mainstream kind of thing, I guess, that this from the Sundance Film Festival, a VR project is received this. So I think that's all good news. The other thing, small news story, and this is to do with Fallout 4 VR. So there has been, I think originally when it was released, I think a couple of weeks afterwards, we did hear word that there would be a patch coming at some point in January, and it has been confirmed now. So there was a tweet that was somebody tweeted out who works at Bethesda, but then also there was a post on Reddit as well, where they said that there will be a update for Fallout 4 VR in a like a beta branch of that game. So you can try that out. I don't know. Let's just have a quick look on this. I think it's within the next week or so.
The copy I saw was from Jess. She posts a lot on Reddit and the relative forums, but she said that the next update will start as a Steam beta next week. I'll also have patch notes ahead of the beta starting, so you can see what to expect. Those will be posted here for your visibility. Thanks again. And then she came back and edited the post and said, "And scopes, woo." Scopes was a big thing that people were looking forward to, or was looking forward to being fixed, because right now if you have a rifle and you can't really hold it up to your eye and get that pass through the lens visibility, I don't even know, because I know scopes were broken. I haven't even tried to snipe. I've kept to using my pistol when playing the game, but I know that scopes are a big point, and then just any general fixes. Hopefully they can figure out a way to make the DLC compatible if you already own the base version of the game, or maybe they can do something to improve performance, because God knows, you know, that game could run a little better.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we can get on to the games that we've been playing this week. That's pretty much all the news we wanted to cover in this episode. It's going to be a slightly shorter episode, but there is one big game, and we've got a couple of others that we want to talk about as well. The main one we want to go through is The Impatient. So this was quite a big release for PSVR last week. This is from Supermassive Games. Now, before we got our hands on this, there were reports coming out, you know, it's only 2 hours long and that kind of stuff. And it's a £30 game, $40 game. So people were a little bit disgruntled about the fact that you've got to pay that high price in order to play a 2 hour game. Well, let me go over to Steve first. I know you've played through this. What do you think?
Well, that's a double-handed sort of compliment I'm going to give this game. Like on one hand, I truly like the game, and as you say, I have not only have I played it, but I completed it. And one reason I was able to complete it, because, you know, I don't have a lot of time these days. I'm very busy on a couple of work projects, so my time in VR is limited, and I was still able to complete this game on release week because it's so flipping short. This is a $40 title, and you know, I didn't get to it until yesterday, and I was able to basically beat it in a day. And I did about 2.5 hours is my runtime. I didn't time it exactly, but it aligns with what a lot of people on Reddit were saying. So at a high level, my take on the game is that I really liked it, but I also liked Until Dawn. I thought Until Dawn Rush of Blood was just a very fun arcade shooter with a good skin on it, you know, within the Until Dawn universe. So I like the game, but in terms of like a recommendation or anything like that, I'm going to say hold. Like, I think as a $10 game, as a $15 game, which this will eventually become, you know, it might take a while, maybe September, October, but at some point you will be able to buy The Impatient for 10, 15 bucks on some sort of sale. And at that point, I think it becomes a fantastic value. Right now, I'm giving it a definite hold on 40 bucks because I do not feel that I got my $40 worth. That said, assigning the dollar to value ratio aside, I did like the game, but that's also because I have a vested time into the Until Dawn franchise. I really enjoyed the main title before, you know, commercial VR was available. I like horror. I like a really narrative, slow-paced games of this nature. So it speaks to me. But there was also a lot broken with it. Like, it felt like, and I don't want to speak in any sort of spoilery sort of way, but it felt like at times it was sort of just like a demo that they fleshed out and made into a game in a way. Like, it was you spend the first, I don't know, 45 minutes or so of the game sort of in one room, and you don't really get to open up and do any real walking or any exploring until after that time has passed. And then even when you get to that point, it's very much just walk down a corridor and just do what they've scripted for you, which isn't inherently bad, but there wasn't a lot of jump scares. There wasn't a lot of meat to the bones. Like, the foundation, I think, was good. There's a lot to like and dislike, but like, it just seemed like a lot of wasted opportunity as well. Like, they could have done so much more. This is not anywhere near as good as Until Dawn. But it's still overall, like, in the grand scheme of VR, like, I was able to play it for, you know, and knock it out in a day. So I did enjoy it enough that after 30 minutes, I wasn't like, screw this game, take the headset off and never boot it up again. So it's good enough to play. But at the same time, it's frustrating because this game could have been so much better.
Yeah, I don't have a big problem with short games or anything like that, but the price really does need to reflect the amount of time, the amount of content that you're going to get out of the game. So I guess from that point of view, you know, I've got a busy schedule, I've got a family, I've got work and this kind of stuff. So if a game is sort of 5 hours long, I don't really mind that. That doesn't bother me, but I do think the price needs to reflect that. First impressions of this game for me were pretty positive initially. I think the graphics do look very, very good. You can see that from all the trailers, and knowing what Supermassive have done in terms of like Until Dawn, the graphics in that particular game were very good as well. Also, sound was one of the first things that stuck out to me. I think they've done the sound very well, the 3D audio in this. I think it worked very well. Once I had got into the game, I did feel like the scale was wrong. I don't know any better way to put it than that. And I looked into this and people were saying how you need to adjust the IPD on the PSVR and this kind of stuff, because apparently IPD adjustment on the PSVR will directly affect world scale. I don't know if this is true or not, because I went in and I tried it from 61 millimeters IPD and I went all the way up to around 72. It didn't seem to make any difference at all in terms of scale. However, I've looked into this and there are some sort of reliable sources that do claim this to be true, that the IPD adjustment in PSVR does affect the scale of the game. Leaving that aside, because I tried this, it didn't make any difference. Did you play with Move controllers, Steve, or did you play on DualShock?
I played with Move controller. I didn't even try it with DualShock because I read that it was sort of equally limiting.
Yeah. I actually found it better with DualShock. I tried it initially with Move controllers. And one of the things with Move controllers, I don't know if you found this, Steve, again, this is all coming down to really like the scale problem that I had with this game, is if... So say in real life, I've got my Move controller in front of me and then the hand represented in VR is sort of where the Move controller is when it's directly in front of me. If I raise the Move controller up, it's almost as if like my hand is accelerating away. Now, it's not one-to-one. It doesn't feel like my hand is actually, wherever the position of the Move controller is, it doesn't feel like it's one-to-one with where my hand is in real life or the hand is represented in VR. And this was a big problem. I really didn't like this aspect of it.
Well, it seems like they really tied a lot. They wanted you to have a body, right? So the whole time in this game, you look down, you have a chest, shoulders, arms. So they wanted you to have a body as opposed to being floating hands. And I can respect that, but it seems like they didn't quite get that working. So a lot of the locomotion, like if you, well, I don't know how it was for DualShock, so I'll be interested in that feedback, but playing with a Move controller, turning, like I could just turn in my space, but it wanted to keep forward based on the way my body was pointing. So if I was facing the camera as I am now, and then I turn 90 degrees and then press the Move button, I still walk the way I was originally facing the camera, not the way I'm facing. So they sort of have this decoupled locomotion where you're decoupled from the headset view and also decoupled from where your hand is pointing, which is interesting because that's one of the things like I always kind of struggle with, like, okay, I don't like my movement coupled to the headset because I want to be able to, you know, look around as I'm walking. So, but at the same time, I also think locomotion that's coupled to wherever the hand is pointing is also kind of bullshit. So they got around that, but it just created this whole other third problem in the sense that you can't freely turn in your play space. You have to actually turn with the in-game controls. So I was battling that quite a bit. So I'd be very curious how the DualShock stacked up against that.
I preferred the DualShock far more playing this game, and even that has its problems. It's not ideal. I don't want to stick on the controls because they are frustrating. I think if you use Move controllers or if you use the DualShock, there's a certain level of frustration on both of them, to be honest. I played Until Dawn, and I really, really enjoyed that game when I played it on PS4. But this game, really going into it, I knew the kind of game that I wanted this to be, and really it did fulfill that part of it. A lot of people will say, you know, it's barely a game, but that's true. But, you know, Until Dawn had a very similar kind of way of gameplay mechanic, really. You're just sort of going through and you're making these decisions. It's a narrative experience. It's more of an experience than a game, I would say. But that's okay. I was expecting that, and that's fine. With the just going back to the graphics quickly as well, I felt like the environments were very dark, like overly dark, more dark than they needed to be in some cases, to the point of where in the PSVR you've got this, because these screens don't cope well with sort of dark spaces, you've got this is it mirror effect, something like that?
It's mirror, which I think is basically just not every pixel can be perfectly lit to the same intensity, so you get this look of you see the little spectacles, you see each pixel.
So that really was prevalent in this game, and it's okay, you know, it's the limitation of the hardware, I guess, to a certain extent, more so. But I'd rather, when I played through this, I was going back to Resident Evil 7, and everything is lit actually quite well in that game. Even the dark areas don't seem quite as bad as they do in this game. And I think I wish they'd have lit the game better, had some better lighting in certain areas, because it's sort of overly done. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but there's a lot of what you mentioned originally, Steve, about the walking through corridors. Okay, the second half of the game, really, you're following people through corridors for a majority of the time. And honestly, it feels at points where they've tried to extend the gameplay to the point where you're just following people for extended lengths of time and doing nothing else. There is almost, I mean, I'm sure there are little diversions that you can make in order to get trophies and that kind of stuff, because I did sort of veer away at one point and got a trophy from that. So there are probably hidden parts in that. But if you're following the narrative structure of this game, you are going through and you're following people down corridors for a vast majority of it. It's really annoying after a while, to be honest. The final thing for me, I don't know, did you play after the credits, Steve, after you after it went through all the credits at the end of the game? It had just a very, very short, like about a 1 minute section where
I didn't know, I turned it off.
If you've played Until Dawn, then it's probably a good idea to go back and play that, because it just it's hardly anything, but it just leads nicely into the Until Dawn game as well. And I thought that was quite clever the way they've done that. It's a little bit like a cheap trick, really, because they brought it all together.
But I think I know what you might be talking about. No, I did not do that. And I think it, depending on the outcome that you got, and I'll ask you after we close the show, just so I know, but depending on the outcome that you got, there are tie-ins. I went ahead after I completed it because I know I'm not going to go back and replay the game. Looked at what some of the other outcomes were, the different endings and the different branches from the decisions and choices that you make. And in general, yes, I think I know what you might be referring to. But overall, I do think the game does tie into the Until Dawn universe pretty well. Like I found myself, there was more than one location where I distinctly remember visiting in the original Until Dawn game, the church thing for one, but then there was this one room where you visit it and it's got a light in it. It's relatively dark. It's after you're able to explore the hallways. But in the original Until Dawn game, that's where the male teenager has to cut his hand off or his fingers off. Like I vaguely remember it, but you have to make that choice in the original game and you're in that room again. And I distinctly remember that room. And I thought that was pretty cool, having that tie-in. But because at the same time, there weren't any real revelations in this game. Like they didn't open up any new narrative. It was more or less kind of reliving the narrative that you already knew. Like you got some more detail because you were living that narrative, but the overall, and this isn't spoilers, but the overall story of Until Dawn is you know, the miners become the Wendigos, and that leads to everything that happens, and there's nothing new to see here. Like it's kind of, you already know that from having played Until Dawn. So that was a little bit of a letdown that there wasn't a little more exploration in the story. And again, I feel like I'm harping, I'm going over negative about this game. But I still think it's a worthy experience. I enjoyed my time with it. I just not at $40.
No, yeah, definitely.
How, like just coming from Wilson's heart, how, I mean, it sounds like it's completely different, basically. Like, is it not even comparable at all?
No, for Wilson's heart's much better.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's not for me. I mean, I can't recommend this game at the price point it is at the moment. And honestly, I think it would need to be about a third of the price in order for me to recommend it. It was disappointing, I'll be honest. It's not something that I think I'll be returning to. And it is a game that could potentially warrant some kind of multiple playthroughs. And I guess that's how they're justifying this price to some extent. But the decisions you make, the butterfly effect decisions you make, are few and far between. And I don't know how different the actual overall experience of that game would be playing through it multiple times. I have no inclination to go back and play through it again. It was an okay experience, but it's definitely not worth that amount of money. I don't want to be too negative on it at the same time. I know I am being, but Supermassive Games are doing some great work in other areas. So Rush of Blood, you know, I've started playing that a little bit on my PSVR as well. Fantastic game. This is a completely different kind of game. I just don't think it quite pulls it off, unfortunately.
Correct. No, one last point I want to make, and I ask your take on it, Gary, is how do you feel about it in terms of actually being scary? Like the few parts of it were scary, but it seemed like they were really far in between. I can only recall off the top of my head maybe two or three jump scares, but like Rush of Blood like had more than that in the first damn level. Well, the second level, the pig level. The first one's more of a tutorial level. And like, I feel like you got this 2.5 hour experience. They could have thrown a lot more fear at you, and they didn't. Like, I was pretty let down by that. What do you think?
Yeah. I agree. I mean, there were probably two or three jump scares in this, and you know, it shouldn't have this over reliance. I don't think any VR game should have this over reliance of jump scares in order to make the experience valid as a horror experience. And I think the best ones don't rely on that. They rely more on the subtlety of horror and the just this unease, this sense of unease. And I think games like A Chair in a Room did this extremely well. And this is where, honestly, I think this is another point where the impatient falls down. It's not really that scary. When I was playing through it, it really didn't feel that scary to me. And that's okay, because some people won't want that. They can get through the game. But it did fall down in that for me. And part of it, part of the reason I think it didn't feel particularly scary to me is I couldn't really get immersed into it because of the frustrations I was having with controls initially. And I think anything that pushes you away in terms of immersiveness just makes you feel like, because you don't feel like you're really there or you're really experiencing any of this stuff, the horror has less impact. But even if I can take that out of it and look at it sort of objectively from sort of taking a step back, I still don't think it was a particularly scary experience in terms of jump scares or the overall ambience of it either.
Yep. And okay. Lastly, I'll say one more. I said last thing, but it just now came to me with the video that I'm playing. Did you use the voice control? We didn't talk about the voice commands at all. And Until Dawn, just for those that haven't played it, it's very narrative, as we've said, but it's also, you know, you'll be at a point where you got to make a conversation or a dialogue choice between A and B, and what you decide can change, you know, sort of what happens in the game, and you can get different outcomes and so on. We've seen that before. But in The Impatient, because Supermassive knows that everyone playing the game has a microphone on and right there, they enabled voice. And I don't remember if the original Until Dawn did that. I'm guessing no. I don't remember ever trying it, but I did go ahead and enable voice commands. And I think if the game had been a little better and I was super immersed, that I would have used the voice commands more. But outside of that, it kind of felt like the early days of Siri, and it was just kind of I didn't really, like, you know, I was just reading what was on the screen as opposed to just pointing at it and clicking.
Yeah, I think I did use it initially only for about the first 10 minutes, and then I decided to move away from that. I didn't really offer anything to me in terms of immersiveness. I guess because they are trying to do that kind of stuff, I suppose, in order to immerse you more in this world, and that makes sense. It's an interesting experiment to do. It just didn't really, I didn't like that way of playing at all, really. But okay. Chris, have you got anything you want to speak about this week that you've been playing?
I mean, not really. Like, it's all stuff we've played. I went on the next game we were going to talk about, a Smithsonian Journey Tour of Venice. I didn't go too far into it because I just looked at it. And I'm like, oh, this is a not very good 360 video. Like, I just looked to my left and the boats were all mismatched and not parallaxing correctly. So I'm just like, eh. If I was into looking at Venice, I'm sure I'd like this, but just from face value of it being a 360 video, I didn't like it. But that's, like, honestly all I can say about that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. I think it was a little bit disappointing for me. I wanted to go into this because my wife and I, we went to Venice on our honeymoon back years ago now, and I loved it. It's one of my favorite places. I thought it was a fantastic place, so I really was interested in going into this. But yeah, it's the same old story, isn't it? You know, 360 videos, it's stereoscopic 360, but it's like you say, Chris, it wasn't parallaxing properly and the resolution's still low, and yeah, just it's disappointing. I think what they've got, the idea they've got there is good and it's sound, but it's the technology just really isn't there to make it an interesting experience at the moment.
Like you, I was in Venice earlier this year, and it was, well, earlier last year, it's now 2018, but I was in Venice like 7 months ago, 8 months ago, and I so all this stuff was fresh in my mind, so I didn't even know this was coming. You had mentioned it, Gary, and I quickly checked it out because I was just there, like, let's do this. And I think it was I think, like to Chris's point, I think it was sort of underwhelming or something wrong with the video. Like we all know 360 video in VR is kind of like it's a little bit janky. Most of the time, it doesn't feel quite right. But in this one, it felt like wrong. It almost like if the stereoscopic view was a little squeezed too much. Like it felt like it was actually like fatiguing to try to watch. Like it wasn't comfortable. Like it hurt me. Not hurt, but it kind of, you know, was like, I don't know how to say it. I was uncomfortable, like physically uncomfortable to try to watch it. And but that aside, like I think, you know, when you boot it up and you can actually back out to a view of the globe and they show another area. I already forgot what it was. I want to say it was somewhere in Africa, but they show another area that they're saying that says coming soon. So I think they're trying to tie this all in together where you'll be able to choose spots almost sort of like Google Earth and then get this educational experience. So what they're trying to do, I think, is fantastic. And there's a lot of content here. I didn't click on every scenario, but you can do several gondola rides. You can do a lot of vantage points in the San Marcos Square. And then there's some along the walking path of various popular basilicas and things like that that are in Venice. So I think there's a lot of content here. It was a 19 gig download. So I think what they're aiming for, I think, is absolutely fantastic. The execution and the video itself, they're clearly learning. And then I think next go around, they'll make it better. So I look forward to that being better. But it's, you know, if you've been to Venice or if you have any Italian curiosity, like maybe you're going to go to Venice and you want to plot out some things that you should check out, this like will help with that. It's worth doing. But outside of that, don't expect the stereoscopic video to look that pleasing or for there to be anything miraculous there.
Yeah, if it was like Myubi, I think it'd be amazing. But
yeah,
nothing can be like Myubi for some reason.
Really good. That was especially good. Just to quickly mention on that Smithsonian Journeys tour of Venice, it's available on the Oculus Store and it's free, so everybody can give that a try if you want to do so. So I want to get on quickly to Primordian. Steve, Chris, I think you've both had a chance to try this. Anthony and I spoke briefly about it last week. What did you think of this game, Chris?
Man, it looks really good. I think, yeah, like it looked insanely good. Just walking through like the forest and stuff was incredible. Like it felt like, it feels so cool being on an alien planet. I feel like there hasn't been that much of that in VR compared to what there could be. For me, the combat wasn't very good, but just the environments themselves are really what sold it for me. And I didn't play too much of it yet, but the environments did leave an impact on me enough that I want to keep playing it for sure, just to kind of see where it goes and the different environments. Yeah, you go ahead.
Did you think like the combat, although, I mean, I completely agree with you. I think in terms of combat, it doesn't do the perfect job or anything like that, but it does, I mentioned last week, it does make you feel like a bit of a badass in terms of like the damage you can do to these enemies. One thing I want to ask both of you, actually, I need to revisit Vanishing Realms now, because to me that still excels in terms of its combat, not in every single way, but just the fact that you feel like you have agency in terms of blocking these attacks and that kind of stuff. And I feel like whenever there's a game that doesn't quite do that, Primordian being one, I don't feel like my specific movements make any particular difference to the attack that I'm doing within that game. Whereas I do feel like that in Vanishing Realms, and maybe I need to revisit that. In my mind, that did it pretty well, but I've not played it for a long time. So maybe I'm just distorting that in my own mind. Steve, what do you think of this in terms of combat?
No, I have the exact same in your mind thought that with Vanishing Realms. The combat here in Primordian is almost non-existent. Like, and I think, you know, I think we got to be, we got to state something, and well, I'm going to state something, you guys jump in if I'm wrong, but if what I recall correctly from several of our emails and stuff, the developer did give us a key to this game, so we did not pay for it. But it's one guy making this, right? Like, am I remembering that correctly?
I believe so. I'm not 100% on that.
I believe. We'll double check. So don't be too harsh in the comments. But I believe it's one guy making this, which is incredibly like mind blowing. But it is one of the best looking games. Like right now, I can't tell you in any sort of absolute terms a game that I think that looks better. And it's not just resolution it's the world that has been created, the vegetation. Like, you're walking through this jungle and you see this giant snake, although you never see its head, you only see its body, coiling around these trees, and you see this giant spider-like creature. Like, it is an incredible looking game. And I think they focused on creating the world first and have gone back and is now working on the combat. I do know there's more content coming. They're going to flesh it out and make it a longer game, but it's the combat itself, to get to your question, Gary, is the movements, the swinging of the swords, the enemy combatant movements, they all look good. Where it falls apart is there is no meat to the combat, in the sense that you can sort of do it Nintendo Wii style, where you just kind of stick your wrist out and waggle your swords. Your swords are completely weightless, and you can just, you know, just kind of just literally do that. Stick your hand out and you'll hit them 37 times in 2 seconds. So that's real sort of broken in that sense, and I didn't see a way to parry. Like, you can tell when the enemy is going to strike, and it gives you a good cue for that, and you can get out of the way, but I didn't see any way to sort of parry the strike or counterattack or do anything that would really flesh out that combat. Whereas in Vanishing Realms, I do specifically remember that sort of stuff. You have a shield and the enemy has a shield. If you hit them on their shield, it kind of does nothing. Whereas in Primordian, you can just kind of stick your hand through their shield and then hit them on the other side. So it is a bit flawed in that sense, but I think where it shines is graphically, because in right now, on the spot, without really researching it and planning ahead, I can't think of a game that looks better.
Yeah, and I want to be fair to this. I don't want to stick on the combat for too long, because for me, the combat is the main downside of this game. Everything else is done very, very well. I think the presentation of it, and as you say, Steve, the graphics look great. And, you know, it guides you through. It's a linear experience. It guides you through this experience. I think it does it very well. And also, you know, this game at the moment, it's an early access game. So it's £18.99 or $24.99 by Stonepunk Studios. And what they've said, this developer did email us about this game. So this initial part for this early access is just 2 hours long. It's the first part of the story. But there will be parts 2, 3, and 4 will be added onto this story. So this could potentially be quite a big game in the end. So if this kind of game, you know, it's like a linear narrative, sort of quite bare bones narrative, at least the part I've played so far, combat game, which is very, very good. So I don't want to just be negative on this, because it's a very, very good game, and I'm hoping that as the early access progresses, they'll get better combat sort of implementation in there as well. I'm sure they can do things to fine tune it.
Yeah. Just one thing, like, that annoyed me, this kind of immersion breaking for me, that I feel like they need to fix, is just, like, you know, when I saw that giant spider thing, I just started walking through trees with the trees not falling. And I don't know, there's just stuff like that that I'm just like, ooh, if I didn't look at that, I would have been way more immersed. I don't know. There's just certain things that aren't polished yet, but I'm hoping that they can eventually get to that.
Yeah. There are certain things that you can point to. I think as we go through this, and you can see things that just need refining slightly. I still think, as an early access game, it's not one of these ones where it's just been thrown out there and it's early access and it's very unpolished, because it's not that kind of experience. There are certain things in there, I agree with you, that are not quite right. But some of the spectacle as well, like the snake, the huge snake that's going around the forest, that looks great as well. Okay. So we've talked about that. Let's talk about Light Tracer. Steve, I think you've played this as well. I've played a little bit of this very briefly, so I won't spend too long on this. Maybe we'll get back to it another week. But for me, so this is a game by Void Dimensions. It's being published by Oasis Games, and it's coming out on the Vive, Rift, and the PSVR. It's £11.39 or $14.99. So this is like a little puzzle game, really. You're presented with this world where you have to use this kind of like a magic wand, where you point a piece of light at the ground, and then this girl will follow the place where you're pointing this light, and you have to navigate her using this method in order to get through these levels. And obviously there's various obstacles and things like that in there. I think the game looks great. It looks very good. you know, it's, there's not a lot to say in terms of the game as a whole, because it's just quite a small puzzle game, I'd say. But I enjoyed it for what it is. It reminded me in some ways, and, you know, I quite like this game, Ropes and Dragons. It's a game that came out a long time ago. Some people didn't particularly like that, but I thought it was good, and my daughter loved it. It's just a very simple kind of puzzle game, and this one reminded me of that game in some ways. I think my daughter would love this one as well. It's not really the kind of game I'd spend any time in at all. Steve, what did you think?
I, similar to you, I quite liked it. I found that I played it for quite a while, I think. I mean, it wasn't 5 hours or anything like that, but I played it, I think, for at least an hour, which I don't do if I don't like a game. So I think you described it. It's very basic. There didn't seem to be, as far as I got, much of a narrative or anything like that, but it's I played it on PlayStation VR. I know it's available on Steam as well. I don't know where you played it, Gary, but I played it on PlayStation VR, and like you say, you grab your motion controller, you point, and the little princess will follow the trace that you made. It's called Light Tracer, and your beam is looks like it's yellow, looks like it's made of light, so it kind of makes sense within the name. But you gotta navigate her through these little three-dimensional worlds that are very, very basic. It's a platformer. You can jump or tell her to jump. You know, you just press the X button and she'll jump and go over gaps, and you gotta avoid enemies, and you gotta figure out things. And there was actually a little boss-like battle that I went through. It took me a little while to beat that. From a difficulty curve, and I don't know if it's just because I was early on, there didn't seem to be a limit. You could just die over and over and over and over, and it just kind of places you right there where you died. So there's, I quickly learned to play sort of free of risk. Like, I was just going at it. Like, I never once felt like I had to conserve lives or do anything. So I started dying quite a lot because I just kind of wanted to move through the terrain fast. But I think it's also targeted somewhat for a younger audience. It's a game that your children can pick up and play. It's presented real cute. I think it looks really, really good. Price-wise, it is $14.99. It's developed by Void Dimensions and published by Oasis Games. And they did give us a key. So you know, the disclaimer there, we didn't pay for it. And I think I haven't showed it to my kids yet, or to my son particularly, but I think he'll enjoy it. It's got a good mechanic, and I'm showing it in the video now, of where you can actually grab the world and zoom in, zoom out, pull it up, pull down to change your vantage point to kind of see. And it seems to also have a sort of a sharp uptick in difficulty. Like, once I got the first chapter where it teaches you sort of how to play the game, the next chapter I had enemies that were throwing boulders at me, and the boulders were kind of rolling down the path, and the difficulty did seem to ramp up quite a bit. So I think it's a good game. At $15, it's sort of in the mobile kind of territory. Well, I guess maybe that's expensive for a mobile game, but it kind of fits in that genre. I could see this being something, absent the motion controller aspect, something that you could play one day on like an Oculus Go or something like that. So all in all, I think I liked it for what it is.
Yeah, there's a lot to like about it. It's just not something that I'll be spending a lot of time in. But like you say, I think for my kids, I think they didn't get a lot out of it. Okay, the last one we've got to talk about this week. Steve, do you want to talk about a handful of Kelflings?
Sure. So Handful of Kelflings is Keflings, I think.
Is it Keflings?
hell, I don't know. I probably should have that sorted out. But apparently this is a game, like, I personally never played it, but it has I don't want to say a cult-like following, but it is a game, a universe, a created thing that a lot of people are aware of. And I believe this game was announced and then released in its current version relatively fast without a lot of people knowing about it. So when I did research on the game, I felt a lot of people saying, like, holy crap, there's a Kelflings game in VR. Like, I didn't know that. It makes me want to get VR right now. So I went on YouTube and looked at some of the earlier games just to kind of see, you know, how they might compare. But in VR, what this game is it's a build 'em. I hesitate to call it a strategy game, even though it's got strategy-like aspects. I didn't see what necessarily the goal was. Initially, graphically in the vibe, it felt a lot like Tethered, which is a game that I liked a lot on PlayStation and eventually came out to PC VR. I think you can pick it up on Steam, both for the Vive and the Rift. But in Tethered, you have levels, and your goal is to get so many spirit points, and then you complete the level. And then there's different ways you can do that, and you can be graded in various categories. In this game, in Handful of Keflings, I didn't see necessarily what the objective was. It seemed like the objective was just to keep building and building and building and building ad infinitum. So that aside, the actual building process was fun. It was a lot of, like any game of its nature, is a lot of micromanaging resources. You got to have the little Keflings, so they look like little elves. You got to have them chopping wood, mining stone. You can refine the wood into planks and refine the stone into cut stone. And then you use those resources to build more buildings, build more homes. When you build homes, you get more Keflings. You can give them jobs. And it's just kind of, it's like a little economy. It's I guess it's like how any country works, right? You give jobs and you build homes and you get more people and more jobs. All that is fine. But my big takeaway is that I didn't see the purpose. Like, what was I building to? Like, when did it end? And I played for like 45 minutes and it just didn't seem like it was going to end. So in that sense, I didn't necessarily like it. But outside of that, I thought it was cute. It was cartoony. It looked good. The building aspects, all of that was fine. A lot like Light Tracer in the sense that I think it could be something that kids could probably pick up relatively soon. It wouldn't be anything for a real young child because it is advanced enough in that sense. But something around like an 8 to 10 year old could probably pick it up and do pretty well.
Yeah. Okay. Good stuff. Well, has anybody got anything else that I've missed off here that they want to talk about at all?
I'm double checking. I don't think I have anything on the list.
Yeah, nothing.
Okay. I guess that's it then. So it's a little bit lighter this week in terms of news. So hopefully, over the next few weeks, I'm sure we'll start getting some more announcements and that kind of stuff. But anyway, thanks for joining us on this episode. This was episode 69 of VR Roundtable. I'm sure Anthony will be back next week, and we'll all see you next time. Please like the video, make a comment, and if you can leave a review on iTunes or any other podcast service, that's always appreciated as well. So thanks for that, and we'll see you next time.
See you, everybody.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.